With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you're listening from, I hope you're safe and well. And today I'm joined by two fabulous authors who'll be going head to head in a war of the words a little later on. My first guest has translated more than 20 books from Spanish, Catalan, and German, among others, and among them Benjamin Labatut's International Booker Prize shortlisted book, When We Cease to Understand the World. His essays and criticism have appeared in the NYRB, the TLS, and many other journals that don't just use initials in print and online. Here to tell us about his new novel, My Father's Diet, it's Adrian Nathan West. Hello to you.
Hi.
And my second guest is the author of 9 novels, which include The Good Doctor and In a Strange Room, both of which were shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And last year, he won the Booker Prize for his novel The Promise, which we'll be talking about today. Damon Galgut, hello, welcome to Book Off.
Hi, glad to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. And we are truly international today because we are joining London, where I am, in the UK, to Cape Town, I believe, to the east coast of America. How is it in Cape Town at the moment, Damon?
It's a late summer's day, really beautiful, not too hot and no wind blowing. So that's unusual for Cape Town. The wind's a constant factor. It's a beautiful day.
Can't complain about the weather, at least. Good. Yeah. And what about you, Nate? Whereabouts do we find you?
So I'm actually in Suwanee, Tennessee. I'm about an hour outside of Chattanooga. It's a small university town. If you even want to call it a town, it's a small university conglomeration of buildings with some people around. And it's a kind of gray, cold day.
Okay. A gray, cold day in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Well, it's lovely to have you both here and be connected by the power of technology. And over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to discuss your brilliant books. We're going to talk about your writing, get some recommendations of things to read. And of course, we'll do the Book Off, where each of you pitches as a book that you love and think that we should all read. But that's for later on. First of all, Damon, I know this is a bit old now, so I'm just going to get it out the way. Congratulations on the Booker Prize there. That's done. You've heard it a million times. For those that might not have got to The Promise yet because they're waiting for the paperback, or they're thinking, oh, I've got that Booker Prize winning novel on my list, I will get to it soon. Could you perhaps set the story up for us?
Yeah, I hope I can do it without making the pretext sound too depressing, because it involves a lot of dying and death. I got the basic idea for the book in a conversation with a friend who was telling me about attending, you know, the funerals of 4 of his family members, his parents and his brother and his sister, over a long period of time, and he's older than me, so none of this, you know, was unduly tragic. But somewhere along the way, it gave me the idea that that might be a non-conventional approach to telling the story of a family. I'm drawn more to unusual narrative approaches than to the narratives themselves these days. I think when you're younger, plot is the sexiest thing around. As you get older, you know, the architecture of plot becomes much more interesting. And I liked the notion of what you could do, you know, with telling a family story that basically just gives you four quite tight frames on that family, you know, with big gaps of time in between. And then, you know, it occurred to me in a secondary sort of way that I could widen the frame a little bit and show something of South Africa in the background. So essentially through these four funerals over 40 years, you're getting a picture of a family in decline and in a secondary sort of way of a nation, probably also in decline, although that wasn't, you know, my intended objective. But in broad terms, that's what I'm covering.
And I heard an interview with you a little while back around the Booker Prize where I think you said brilliantly, I've got a bit older now and so I just don't really care as much about what people think. And I loved that sort of attitude that you had in terms of what you were writing, what you wanted to do.
It matters more than you might think. I mean, I know it makes a good soundbite, but in fact, it's quite liberating. If you happen to be a writer who's spent a lot of years inhibited in some way, which is to say all writers, by the idea of what people think of them or think of how they express themselves and so on. There's always a kind of tiny, tight little self-censoring voice in the head somewhere, I think. But somehow I got rid of that by getting older and ceasing to care that much. And it's frankly, the repercussions in a literary sense are quite fruitful.
Yeah, it's great to hear. And you sort of just touched on this, but the book takes place over four decades. Was that something you always knew you wanted to do with this book? And was that a span of time you always thought that you would write?
No, it's hard to be exact about when the various components of the book sort of fell into place, but they really don't tend to, you know, snap into position all at once. It tends to be quite a slow process of figuring stuff out. But the moment I'd realized that actually I could say something about South Africa too in this narrative arc, that then it became a question, well, at what points in time are you situating these funerals? Because whatever you're focusing on in the background should be evocative of something. And then, of course, you know, the notion that each funeral's in a totally different decade with a different president in power in South Africa soon sort of showed itself to my imagination, and I saw the possibilities of that. But no, things sort of percolate and trickle down into place. It's not a high tech putting each idea in its category business with me. I mean, I'm sure it is with some people, but I lack whatever chemical is required.
And just on cue, talking about funerals, the church that's just across the way from me has started doing some bell ringing practice, I think, which you might be able to hear in the background, just floating in there to give us a bit of a nice soundtrack. Nate, if we could talk about My Father's Diet. This novel is many things, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's a fictionalized sort of memoir. It's a portrait of a life crisis. It's a darkly humorous story. Can you set up this book for us and the listeners?
So the book is a story narrated by a young man of his father's return to the town where he was born. The town is meant to be very anonymous. The characters are meant to be somewhat anonymous. There are very few people who are actually named in the book. It should be a place that could be located really anywhere in America. And the father is estranged by his own designs because he left to pursue an advanced degree in order to make something of himself, as he says. He misses what are really the most important years of the son's life, I think, from, say, 2 to 20. He returns and he says, well, now I want us to really get to know each other. And there's a bit of a self-helpy, American self-help style inflection there when he says, perhaps we don't have a relationship, but we can try to make a new relationship or something like this. Well, the father returns with a new wife who is a bit like an adventitious plant. She can't grow in the new soil. She starts to lose her mind. She really does lose her mind. And at the point where she's leaving the father and the father is in a state of absolute despair, he begins a short series of confessions to his son in which the son thinks, well, he's about to tell me that he's going to commit suicide or something drastic like this. But instead he says, I'm going to do a 12-week physique transformation challenge. And then the remainder of the book is the story of the father's struggle to acquire a bodybuilder's physique, and perhaps, hopefully, the existential, if you will, issues that feed into his desire to make this rather quixotic choice.
And it's got lots of humour, dark, sort of subtle humour throughout, which I really enjoyed. And with both of these books, Damon sort of touched on it, I suppose, just earlier about sort of being able to tell a bit of the story of South Africa as well. In the same sort of way with your book, Nate, it felt a little bit to me like there was a bit of a critique on America, on the sort of American way of living that comes through what the characters are like and what they're doing.
It's strange. A part of me is very critical of all of that, but then a part of me also understands it quite well. I thought of this during the pandemic because I had been in Europe and we were very locked down and nobody could do anything. And at one point I went to visit my family in the American South. Well, everything was open and it was very sunny and you could go do whatever you want. And there is, of course, everybody's buying things all the time. And it made me think of this wonderful book by Georges Perec, The Things, where there's this optimism invested in purchasing things and in creating a life out of things. Of course, it's nonsense, and a lot of people are completely miserable, but you can see this messianism in constant purchasing. And I wanted to show that, but I also wanted to show the aftermath of that, where what you get when you have a society of people buying things all the time is a society full of garbage, and garbage buildings and entire parts of towns that have been abandoned. So I don't want to say it's a critique in a radical sense, because I'm not a particularly sure. radical person, but it is simply looking around and seeing the enormous waste produced by this lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. Much better way of putting it than me. And how much of you is actually in this book, Nate? Because I sort of said it's a fictionalized memoir. I don't know if that's true, but I feel like there's definitely something personal coming through here.
Of course. I think the truth is this. You stand on the shore of your life, and the ocean throws up all this flotsam, and you pick it up and you try to make something out of it. So I wouldn't describe it as a memoir per se. For example, my narrator is restrained. My narrator is very timid. I wasn't especially like that. Of course, I've been timid in situations. Even when my narrator goes to the gym with his father, he has no idea what to do and everything seems quite strange to him. Actually, I'm a big gym nut. But of course, a lot of it is true. Of course, there are a lot of things that are true. And particularly, you know, there's a figure in the book later when the narrator goes to visit a former girlfriend of his. And that was something, a little tribute to a person that I knew. So
bits.
Yeah, bits, exactly.
Yeah. Damon, just to come back to you and to the promise, if I may, your narrator sort of swoops in and out of characters' consciousnesses. And sometimes the you is the reader. Sometimes it's a character talking to another, sometimes just talking to themselves. How did this technique come about? Because I found it such a joy to read this, but it's so, you know, so different and really original. I just wondered if there was a spark for this, writing it this way.
Yeah, well, the spark was a sort of diversion from the writing of the novel, actually. I was about 3 months in, I think, and I got offered a passing job writing a couple of drafts of a film script, which I went off to do. Don't think there's very much of my film script left in the movie, but it did have a salutary effect on my imagination, in the sense that when I came back to my book, I suddenly saw that you could apply a sort of cinematic logic to prose. And it was very freeing for me, because I guess I'd been fretting with the confines of a third-person voice. I mean, even an omniscient narrator has to operate within certain bounds, usually. But I, you know, the thing about cinema is it cuts all the time from one point of view to another. And I, you know, what the one thing cinema can't do is do that internally. It can do it in the way that a camera can observe, which is to say from the outside. But books, of course, do work internally. You know, the greater part of a book's landscape takes place inside its characters, I think. So by extending that language, you could actually cut from the inner life of one character to the inner life of another, right inside some totally different situation. And the freedom with that very fast and sort of right-angled movement, if you like, where you're kind of snapping off a point of view in favor of another one, was exciting to me. It didn't feel to me like something I'd read before, even though one has encountered variations on that approach, maybe, which is quite energizing in in one sense, but on the other hand is also quite conducive to insecurity. So, you know, a lot of this book, a lot of the writing of the book was, you know, occupied with me worrying whether the writing was actually working. You know, to some degree, that's always a concern, no matter what one is working on, but it took on a very acute character in this case. But essentially, that was the spark for it. And it's one of those things where you hit on a particular approach, which ultimately you stick with because in some way it aligns with your own sensibility. In other words, it fits very well with the way my own brain perceives the world. So that's always a good platform, I think, for creating. But, you know, not strong enough to quite erase the doubts. Not until you're done, I guess.
Yes, right. And I loved the Fellini quote right at the front of the book.
Yeah, that quote kind of preceded the book by some time. It's, you know, I keep a journal of little, you know, odd notes and scratchings to myself and so on. And I'd pick that up in an interview with him along the way. And I'd always found it a kind of fabulous quote. But it, again, it suggested itself as, you know, the first step of the, you know, the staircase I was building, if you want to see a book as a staircase.
Yes. But
it seemed like the natural first step.
Before I ask you both about books that you've been reading and enjoying recently, I just want to ask about translation, Nate, if I may, because when I was hosting the Booker Prize podcast when it was in existence, and indeed the International Prize, I would really love speaking to translators and authors and getting a taste of that dynamic of working together, of the fact that you have to take on an author's work and essentially write it yourself again, but trying to be true to it. You've worked with lots of different people. Are you doing a lot more translating at the moment? Is it something that you keep up?
I'm trying to do less translation at the moment. 2021 was a very difficult year for me because I had taken on a lot of work. And so I don't even know how many translations that are about to come out, you know, 7 or 8 or something like that. And so really I'm trying to focus on writing now. Given the opportunity, I would like to plug one translation, which is a wonderful book by the Swiss author Hermann Berger. It's called Brenner, and it's a sort of Proust with cigars, but much crazier than Proust. And I'd like to plug it because it's the most difficult thing I've ever done, and I think it's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. So Berger, I do want to continue with. I'd like that to be a marriage as opposed to a fling.
Yeah. So have you mainly just had flings so far?
To an extent. So there's an Austrian writer, Josef Winkler, whom I've translated a couple of books by. I've done 2 books by Alejo Carpentier, which are about to come out. But in general, it's more flings than marriages. That's true.
Because I know there's a wonderful translator and author in her own right, Jennifer Croft, who I have got to know through various Booker Prizes, international Booker Prizes. And she works very closely with Olga Tokarczuk. I believe. I think that they are. That's a marriage. Definitely.
That's a marriage. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I've apparently the cliche of traduttore traditore. I've taken it too far. I'm going out with too many authors.
Yes. Exactly. Great. Well, I just wanted to talk about that other side of your sort of career and writing, because I think it's a really interesting side to it. And you know,
at times it's mutually fruitful, and at times it's mutually detrimental. It depends on the day.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay. So it'd be great to just ask you what you've been reading and enjoying recently. We love to share books on this podcast and give recommendations where we can. Have you been reading much recently, Damon? Is there anything that you'd like to shout about?
Yeah, although it's a kind of an odd shout, I guess. I tend to do a lot of retrospective reading, older books that you sort of happen on rather than stuff that's been pushed at you on a daily basis. Anyway, I picked up some time ago a reissuing, I guess, of writings by someone called William Roughhead, who was a Scottish true crime reporter, I guess. You know, way before Netflix and all the streaming services did it, trials were covered by people who had to write them up and make them as compelling, I guess, as Netflix tries to do. And he does an exceptionally good job. So anyway, the New York Review of Books has reissued them as a classic, and I can see why, because they're incredibly well written, with a very dry, irony to them, and they're dealing with some absolutely appalling behavior. I'm a sucker, I'm afraid, for, you know, really shabby true crime sagas. I love the mixture of twisted psychology and dark situations. And then usually there's a kind of a drama, in the sense that people get caught and there's a trial. And the trial tends to provide a sort of high register of language, and there's usually a low register somewhere else. So I think true crime writing offers a lot of possibilities for serious writers. It's just not generally taken that seriously. But William Ruffhead clearly took his work very seriously, and I really have had an enormous amount of fun reading them. There are also crimes that took place a very, very long time ago, as in, you know, people before my time. So
yeah,
they take on a certain unreal quality, as opposed to the one is maybe too conscious of the damage done in crimes that are current, whereas old crime feels like it's fiction.
Yes. And so you get a little slice of history as well along with it, I suppose. That's the other thing.
Well, you do, yes, yes. You get a whole lot of cultural stuff that you have to figure out. So I've really enjoyed it. That's probably not a very literary punt on my part, but I feel no shame.
No, that's great. That's good. Thank you. And what about you, Nate? Have you been reading recently, and have you got some recommendations for us? Not just the ones you've translated.
Of course. I've been doing a bit of research lately into an eccentric Swiss author named Fritz Zorn. So Fritz Zorn has an improbable name, which sounds like Fritz Rage. And his real name, because that's a pen name, was even more improbable, which is Fritz Angst or Fritz Fear. And he felt that he would effect a change in his identity from fear to rage by writing this incredibly bizarre book, which is called Mars. And it's effectively his indictment of his parents, his upbringing, and his Swiss society, which he felt had given him a psychosomatic cancer, which he died of. The book begins, "I'm young, rich, and educated, and I'm unhappy, neurotic, and alone," which I think is a wonderful beginning. And he knows he's dying as he writes the book, although he does have hope that if he can excise these cultural problems and these problems of his upbringing, he can finally become a whole person again. It appears not to have worked. But the book is an exercise in absolutely brutal truth-telling. And also, though it's strange to say, it's very funny, because he's so outrageous in his critiques of absolutely everything. So I've been reading a lot about him. He wrote a strange letter to this girl that he knew in high school, which she then published as a book with her own response to it. And I actually got in touch with her. And so I'm hoping to meet her sister in Madrid and talk to her a bit about this wonderful character. Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, so that would be great, wouldn't it? That's going to be fascinating if you manage to do that. Brilliant. Great. Thank you for that recommendation.
That phrase, psychosomatic cancer, I mean, is that a thing?
I believe that it's not a thing. But he was quite uncertain that it was.
But I mean, did he effectively give himself cancer by believing he had it? Is that...
No, he was diagnosed with cancer, and he came to the conclusion that its origins were psychosomatic.
All right, okay.
And probably genetic, he says, because Swiss society he considers to be completely degenerate.
Right.
So...
Never came to South Africa, clearly.
No, in fact, he brings up Africa at times, but of course his notions of Africa, because he's a very rich sort of Swiss pretty boy, his notions of Africa are sort of noble savage ideas. So at one point he's talking about how he confronts his death versus how an African, in quotation marks, confronts their death, and it's obviously the sort of nonsense you would expect.
Right. Quite fascinating. Okay, you got my attention on that.
Damon's writing this down now. He's like,
it's a wonderful book. And as I say, although it's perverse to say, the book is hilarious. So you really laugh all through the thing because you admire him for the courage of his convictions, but also his convictions are preposterous. So you're constantly chuckling at them.
Right.
Just remind us of the title, mate.
Yes, Mars by Fritz Zorn.
Great. Thank you both for those recommendations. Really interesting, actually. And before we do the book off, I'm keen to know what's next for you both. Damon, did you already have a new book on the go or a project in mind when the Booker Prize came along? Because I know from speaking to previous winners that if you don't have something and that happens, you're sort of thrown off kilter a bit.
Yeah, I've been thrown off kilter anyway. I did have a collection of short stories in the works, and I was quite peacefully meandering through the thickets of the short stories, and the Booker fell. Yeah, it's all on hold at the moment, but I will return to them. I'm sort of midway through the book of stories, which have a vaguely common theme in that they're all about people who are far away from home, sort of going on the theory that people who are not at home behave differently to the way, you know, those same people might do when they're at home.
Mm.
So, yeah, it may take a while yet, but there is something keeping me off.
Fantastic. Oh, we look forward to that whenever it may surface. And Nate, obviously, you said you're concentrating on your own writing. This is your second book that you published, My Father's Diet. So, what's next? Is it going to be more fiction?
It will be more fiction in principle. If my life works out as I would like for it to work out in the next year or two, I'll be writing a novel about Alzheimer's and about the way that we have come to treat older people, and particularly weak and infirm older people in America, but in Western societies in general. I mean, I live in Spain and I see the same thing in Spain as well.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Well, thank you both for those recommendations. Thanks for giving us a tease about what is coming up for you both. But now it's time for the book off. This is where each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book that you really like and that you think we should all read. Now, you don't have to use the 3 minutes if you don't want to, but if you're still talking at the 3 minute mark, I'm either going to honk you out with the horn or ring you out with the school bell. So a little bit of admin before we get into it. Nate, would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
I think I will cede the floor to the Booker Prize winner in that regard.
I'm sure he's thrilled about that.
Sure.
And David, so at your 3 minute mark, if you are still talking, would you prefer the school bell or the bicycle horn as your note to stop?
School bell has more of an authoritarian ring in my mental association box, but I doubt I'm going to still be speaking after 3 minutes.
Okay. no problem. The bell it is. Well, just before I start the clock then, why don't you tell us the book that you're putting forward?
The book I'm putting forward is My Dog Tulip by J.R. Ackerley.
Fantastic. All right, 3 minutes on the clock if you wish to use them. And it's over to you, Damon, uninterrupted, to tell us about your book.
Well, I first came across J.R. Ackerley when I was researching my book on E.M. Forster. And Ackerley was part of Forster's circle in later years. And he preceded Forster on a visit to India, where he worked as the private secretary to a Maharaja, a job that he then recommended Forster for and that Forster took up later. But Ackerley's account of that period in India, he wrote up as a book called Hindu Holiday, which is a fabulous book. And it led me to some of his other writings. Wonderful though it is, Hindu Holiday isn't the one that caught my attention today. He has another memoir called My Father and Myself, one of the most honest accounts of a father-son relationship you're ever likely to read. And I think Ackerley's great strength was in memoir, and particularly because he was a highly eccentric writer. Nowhere did this eccentricity reach its peak more fully than in this account of what really is a love affair with a dog. His Alsatian Tulip was his constant companion. Actually, he was much better with dogs than he was with people. And this book is a full, frank, unabridged account of what truly is a kind of passion, perhaps perverse. Well, only perverse in the sense that you feel the book is full of longings that could go to dark and dangerous places. One hopes they were never acted upon, but certainly Tulip stood in for a lot of human relationships in J.R. Ackerley's life. He's very open and honest about it, and the result, I think, is funny, moving, touching, and deeply memorable. For all animal lovers, and even for those who don't care for animals, it's a book I would really, really strongly urge you to read if you have ever felt a passion or a tenderness for any other living creature at all. You'll find its echo here. Thank you.
Fantastic. You can have a bit of the bell anyway, even though you had 40 seconds to spare, David, as you so rightly predicted, you didn't go all the way through. Oh, that book sounds absolutely bonkers. And we'll come back and talk about it a bit more, if that's okay, in just a moment. But you can have a breather now. I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock because it's Nate's turn. But just before we start it, Nate, what book are you putting forward in the book off?
I'm putting forward Caput by Curzio Malaparte.
Fantastic. All right, 3 minutes back on the clock then. Uninterrupted, over to you to tell us about Caput.
So I wanted to choose something maybe not entirely fashionable, something that's a little bit out of the current. And Curzio Malaparte was really an obvious choice for that. Malaparte was a wonderful liar, a wonderful writer. But what I wanted to say is above that, perhaps a really magnificent liar. And in his case, I think that's something that kind of has to be celebrated rather than despised. The beginning of Caput coincides with the beginning of the Nazi campaign in the East, much of which Malaparte witnessed as a diplomat and as a journalist. And I think that what he saw really was enough of the conflict to figure out how it could be told better than the way it really happened, in a sense. And so, Malaparte attributes a great deal of moral rectitude to himself, but if he really had possessed that rectitude, he never would have seen all of the things that he saw. He was vain, he was cynical, and he saved the good stuff for these fictions that are real enough to be believed and at their best, I think, express truths that sometimes transcend the bare facts. So, to give you an example, in life, he was a fair linguist. He spoke excellent French and he spoke English pretty well. But in the book, of course, he speaks fluent Romanian, fluent Russian, fluent German. And the peasants, prostitutes, and murderers tell him their deepest thoughts and their deepest misgivings. He interviews Anton Pavlovich, who's the future dictator of Croatia and the head of the Ustashi. And he imagines he sees a basket of oysters or mussels on his desk. But Pavlovich tells him, no, that's 40 pounds of human eyes that I've been given by my soldiers. Surely this didn't happen, but it tells you a great deal about Pavlik and about the immense cruelty of the Ustashe. At one point, he is talking about the Germans, whom he's very brilliant on. And he wasn't politically above suspicion himself, He was a fascist at one point. He was imprisoned by Mussolini, and he claimed that it was because of his anti-fascist convictions. But the truth was, it was because he had defamed a person that Mussolini liked better than him. However, he was horrified by what the Nazis were doing, and he saw very clearly that it wasn't war, that it was organized murder and rapine. And he writes, "The Germans fear the defenseless, the weak, and the sick. They're jealous of the mysterious nobility of the oppressed. And once they've revealed their corruption, they're consigned to eliminate anyone who's borne witness to it." I'm sure this was true, and it's a trait I see sometimes in America, too, this cult of sort of abject self-sufficiency, if that term makes sense, that combines this commodified bravura with the sort of pants-pissing horror of anyone who hasn't made it or can't make it or is disallowed from making the gestures to show that they're exactly like you. Malaparte captures all these things wonderfully, I think a lot about a quote from him in one of his movies where he says, not even freedom has been capable of making us free people. And I think this is a wonderful quote, and it says a great deal to me about the situation that we're in these rich countries in the West.
Fantastic. With 2 seconds to spare, Nate, it's like you put a timer on yourself. And a lovely quote to end on. Fabulous. Thank you very much for that. I don't know where to start with these two. Damon, you absolutely have sold me on this book. Instantly it makes me want to read it. I don't have a dog. I don't actually have a pet, but, it feels like it could be quite amusing. And unlike anything else.
Well, yeah, There is that. I mean, that's the thing about eccentricity, right? It's eccentric because it's not quite like what everybody else is doing. But it does have a very dark edge. Well, not very, but it skirts a dark edge, it has to be said.
It feels to me that it might be a... It feels like because it's mainly, and maybe it's not just mainly about his sort of relationship with this dog, but that it would be quite a short sort of story. But maybe there's more to it than that.
It's 200 pages, if that counts as substantial. But, you know, any great love can pour forth in quantity, you know. And this is a novel of passion, like Lolita. It's not a novel. It's a memoir. And anyway, whether or not you have a dog, you should give it a try sometime. It really is worth it. Off the wall.
Oh, I absolutely will. I mean, it sounds bonkers and brilliant. So thank you for bringing it to our attention, because it really does make me want to read it. And Nate, another fabulous pitch. So Curzio Malaparte was a war correspondent, if I'm right. And he made films, didn't he, as well as write?
He made films as well, because he was very vain and very ambitious, and I think he wanted to try his hand at anything. And I think also when somebody else did something and did well at it, he thought, oh, well, this person is second rate, I can certainly do this better. So yes, he did do some films as well. Medium quality,
okay. But yeah, I sort of love how you open the pitch with saying, I'm going to do talk about something that's not very fashionable. And that he's a sort of brilliant writer, but a magnificent liar. The fact that you're sort of celebrating that, and that, you know, within this book, you're talking about things that probably definitely didn't happen, and yet it tells us a great deal through those sort of embellishments, I just think is wonderful. And this book, again, you know, much like Damon's choice, sounds like nothing I've ever read before, possibly.
It's really quite mad. So he comes up with these strange metaphors for events that are happening in the war, but he pretends that they're real. And I think that if you were conversing with him, he would try to convince you that these things had really happened.
Right.
So he tells a wonderful story, for example, about a German general, I believe, who's trying to catch a salmon in a river. And the salmon, of course, is overcoming the German at every turn. And so finally he has to plant these battalions of soldiers on both sides of the river to trap the salmon so he could try to hunt it down. And it's a wonderful metaphor for the very undignified nature in which the Germans waged that war.
Yeah.
But at the same time of the, I don't really like the phrase, the triumph of the spirit, but in a sense it's true. In a sense, Malaparte's watching these people and saying, somebody with such a preposterous pursuit, they're never going to win. They're never going to win in the end.
I just love the sound of it. And I don't think I've seen a Malaparte film. I've definitely not read a Malaparte book. So I'm now intrigued by him. I'm intrigued by this book. I mean, I want to add both of them to the to-be-read pile straight away. So I'll be ordering them after this. Oh, that's a tough decision, but... I think I'm going to take Caput as the winner, just by a hair, because of your fabulous pitch.
Even I want to.
Even you want to read it, Damon, which is great.
I wanted to actually, if I can ask Damon a quick question.
Of course.
Have you ever read a book by, there's a French philosopher named Jean Grenier who wrote this book called On the Death of a Dog?
No, although that title rings a bell. No,
it's very short. It can't be more than 50 or 60 pages, but I really recommend it very highly. So I'm a great dog lover myself, and it's incredibly profound and beautiful and sad. And if you like dog literature, I recommend it very highly.
Well, it's not a genre I'm committed to. It just so happens. Three books I'm going to have to read after this conversation.
I know. That's the problem with this, you see. The list grows ever longer. But my dog Tulip does sound absolutely brilliant, Damon. So thank you for that pitch, because I definitely want to read it. I want to see what this is all about and learn a bit more about him as well. Thank you both for those brilliant pitches. Thank you both for being here. And The Promise by Damon Galgut is out now. It's published by Vintage. And My Father's Diet by Adrian Nathan West is also out now. And it's published by And Other Stories. And both of them are really great reads. I can highly recommend them both to add to all the other books that you've written down from listening to this podcast. Damon, Nate, what an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.